It's December the 26th, and you're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader and flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman. Welcome to this Boxing Day edition of Weekly Reveille, and today we have news from our military news websites, as well as our Veterans Service Organization's websites and publications, and of course from the Veterans Administration. So, starting out with the military news websites, we begin with Stripes.com, the official website of the Stars and Stripes newspaper. Our first item from Stars and Stripes is by Linda F. Hershey. Lawmakers urge VA to halt mega tech projects and focus on small updates that work. Washington. Mega projects to modernize technology, the Department of Veterans Affairs continually stumble and fail when the agency should take an iterative approach for updating computer systems one piece at a time, House lawmakers told VA officials Thursday. While the electronic health record system update and several other major projects sound good in theory, they've been over budget by billions of dollars and failed to function properly, Representative Matt Rosendale, Republican of Montana, said during a House Veterans Affairs Committee subpanel hearing that identified mistakes delaying the VA's technology updates. The larger the project gets, the harder it is to manage and the less likely it is to ever deliver useful capability, said Rosendale, chairman of the committee's subpanel on modernization. As we close out this session of Congress, I want to emphasize lessons learned. We need to build a nimbler VA that's more responsive to the VA's needs. At the two-hour hearing, technology specialists and a representative from the Government Accountability Office discussed repeated missteps the VA has made and emphasized the importance of adopting new strategies in modernizing technology systems. Describing large technology upgrades as black holes that suck money, Rosendale warned the projects often span decades but render products that are obsolete by the time they are delivered. Representative Sheila Cherfilius McCormick of Florida, the top Democrat on the subpanel, said, "Many of the VA's computer systems are operating beyond their service life and create challenges for the VA's staff to do their jobs. We need to ensure that VA employees have the best tools to do their job," she said. Management of the VA's technology modernization efforts continue to pose high risks, said Carol Harris, Director of Information Technology and Cybersecurity Team at the GAO. The Federal Watchdog's recommended approach to the VA is to break complex technology projects into smaller, more manageable pieces, Harris said. "You are delivering system functionality within weeks and months instead of years," she said. The GAO has made 20 recommendations from recent reviews to improve technology acquisitions and management, though none has been implemented, Harris said. They cover health care and financial management systems, among other areas, she said, and the VA's monolithic approach to projects requires developing requirements at the start of a project. But then when you deploy 5 to 7 years out, you realize it's not going to meet your mission needs. You're set up to fail, Harris said. Lynn Overman, director of the Beek Center for Social Impact and Innovation at Georgetown University, told lawmakers that the only large technology project she can think of that was rolled out on time as planned was the Defense Department's cloud migration project. But she said the development also used an iterative approach, first testing the system with 11,000 users before scaling it to 3.2 million people. Reynald Schweikenhardt, a senior fellow at the Foundation for American Innovation, said, "There needs to be a continual process for updating computer systems and not a one-time effort. When organizations undertake a single large technology project, the staff sees it as their only opportunity to make improvements, and they add on even more requests. Everything depends on the success or failure of that single large project," Schweikenhardt said. Kurt Delbene, the VA Assistant Secretary for Information and Technology, testified on a second panel later in the hearing. He said the VA recognizes its recent mistakes in trying to execute large technology projects. Delbene said, "The agency is changing strategies to approach projects in pieces, introduce changes, and test them with users. We're resetting to get it right," he said. But Delbene also warned the VA's technology budget in 2025 is down from last year in areas that include technology development, modernization, and infrastructure readiness. The VA's fiscal 2025 budget request for the Office of Information and Technology is $6.2 billion, which includes $4.5 billion for operations and maintenance and $1.7 billion for staffing and administrative support. Modernization efforts are down more than 60% from 2024, he said. Delbene said the Office of Information and Technology is focused on maintaining services and improving execution in 2025. "It's a very challenging budget," he said, adding decisions are being made about which projects to invest in for 2025. That's lawmakers urge VA to halt mega tech projects and focus on small updates that work. Our next article is from the 20th of December, again by Linda Hershey. Suicide rate among veterans held steady in 2022, with guns accounting for most deaths, VA's latest report concludes. Washington. The number of veteran suicides continued to hold steady in 2022, despite an infusion of $13.5 billion in funds for mental health services for former service members, according to newly released findings from the Department of Veterans Affairs. Veteran suicides rose to 6,407 for calendar year 2022, up by 3 from the previous year, according to the VA's 2024 National Veteran Suicide Prevention Annual Report that examined suicides by population groups of veterans. The report showed firearms death contributed to most veteran suicides, used in 75% of suicides by male veterans, up 2% from the previous year. Firearms were used in about 45% of suicides among female veterans, down 6% from 2021, the VA said. Firearms account for more suicides among veterans than in the non-veteran general population, according to the report. From 2021 to 2022, the percentage of veteran suicides involving firearms increased about 7%. Overall, the suicide rate among male veterans was up 1.6% in 2022, but the rate among women dropped significantly by about 24%. The suicide rate increase for male veterans was comparable to the general population, but the suicide rate among women in the general population went up by more than 5%. Suicide rates were down among veterans who are homeless, but showed an increase among former service members with certain serious psychiatric disorders. Ra Jean Dorsey, 49, a former Navy seaman, said Thursday he had struggled with homelessness and thoughts of suicide since his military service from 1998 to 2000. Dorsey, who was camped outside Shepherd's Table Soup Kitchen in Silver Spring, Maryland, said worsening psychiatric problems made it difficult for him to navigate the VA system to qualify for health care and other benefits related to his depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, a condition that afflicts people who have experienced terrifying events. Veterans diagnosed with PTSD are at higher risk of death from suicide and accidental injury, according to the National Institutes of Health. "I've been trying to apply for all types of assistance, but getting nowhere. It's hard to get anything done," he said. Dorsey said he now receives assistance at a county resource center with prescription medications, where a caseworker is trying to help him get housing and qualify for VA care. Another veteran standing outside the Shepherd's Table said he thinks some former service members just need to be better directed to care. The 58-year-old former Army sergeant, who declined to use his name, said he sees a lot of veterans on the streets with mental health and addiction problems. Some of these guys are psychotic and need extra help getting their care, he said. They're lost. In 2022, the VA launched several efforts to address suicide among veterans, including a 988+1 crisis line for immediate assistance. Nearly 1 million veterans contacted the crisis line in 2022, which included phone calls, texts, and chats. The VA also expanded support for suicidal veterans that includes free health care, regardless of whether the veteran is enrolled in VA health care. The VA provides free emergency care at VA and non-VA facilities for veterans in active suicidal crisis, according to the agency. More than 85,000 veterans sought help in 2024. The VA's budget request for programs to address the mental health needs of veterans has been on a steady climb, increasing from $13.5 billion in fiscal 2022 to $17.1 billion for fiscal 2025. There's nothing more important to VA than ending veteran suicide, VA Secretary Dennis McDonough said. We will learn from this report to better serve veterans and save lives. But Representative Mike Boast, Republican of Illinois, who's chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, raised questions about the VA's effectiveness in stemming veteran suicides, despite funding increases for programs. Our veteran community continues to battle an epidemic caused by the invisible wounds from their service in uniform, Boast wrote in a letter to McDonough prior to the report's release. It is unfathomable that the mental health budget has increased by billions, but the suicide rate has not budged. As a response to veteran mental health needs, the VA has eliminated co-payments for the first three mental health care visits each year, increased its workforce of clinicians by 27% since 2020 to more than 30,000, and provides night and weekend appointments at many locations, said Mark Ledesma, spokesman at the Veterans Health Administration. In 2022, suicide rates for veterans with other psychotic disorders rose about 14% from the prior year. These are veterans experiencing serious psychiatric disorders, but do not have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. The suicide rate for veterans diagnosed with a sedative use disorder rose in 2022 by nearly 30%. Sedatives are defined as prescription drugs that include Valium, Xanax, and Ativan, which commonly treat anxiety, insomnia, and seizure disorders. The report also highlighted a 19% drop in suicides among homeless veterans in 2022. The VA housed more than 40,000 homeless veterans for the calendar year. The overall number of 6,407 veteran suicides in 2022 is lower than 12 of the previous 14 years, the VA said, but more than in 2021. By contrast, there were 41,484 suicides in the general population, which was 1,476 higher than in 2021. The average number of suicides per day in the non-veteran general population was 131.2, compared to an average 17.6 among veterans, the VA said. The VA described the annual report as critical to informing public health strategy for addressing suicide risks among veterans. It represents the nation's largest national analysis of veteran suicide rates annually, the agency said. The VA also provided numbers from 2021 to 2022 showing a long-term decline in suicide rates among veterans with certain mental illnesses who are receiving their care at the VA. Suicide rates fell by 34% for veterans with depression and by 31.6% for veterans with PTSD. That suicide rate among veterans held steady in 2022, with guns accounting for most deaths, VA latest report concludes. We're going to turn to military.com for this Christmas story from American Military History, The Other Christmas Truce. This is by Joanna Gilden, and it's from the 23rd of December. The holiday season usually comes with promises of peace on earth and goodwill toward men, and yet, in the whole of human history, there's been likely never been a single Christmas celebrated free from war worldwide. Perhaps that's why stories of a wartime Christmas truce tend to capture our attention, offering the promise of peace amid even the bloodiest of conflicts, if only for a short while. The most well-known holiday ceasefire is likely the Christmas Truce of 1914, which was actually a series of small truces that occurred sporadically and spontaneously across the Western Front during World War I. In most recountings, German, French, and British soldiers held burials and prisoner swaps. In rarer instances, soldiers met in the middle of no man's land, sharing provisions and drinks, singing carols, and, according to some disputed claims, even playing soccer. But while cinematic in its scale, the famous Christmas Truce of 1914 was not the first holiday armistice to take place during wartime. Cessations in hostilities have happened, both officially and otherwise, throughout history and across nations, including on American soil. Cue the Ken Burns documentary music. We have a Civil War story for you. Christmas Day, 1862. Less than 2 weeks earlier, the Union and Confederate armies had fought street by street, hand to hand, in the First Battle of Fredericksburg. Repelled by the South, Union troops were forced to retreat to the other side of the Rappahannock River, while the Confederates occupied and decimated Fredericksburg. Union forces began digging in, building log cabins, and hunkering down in their winter quarters. While the encampments might have been similar, scant food, little warmth, and questionable housing, the morale was drastically different. It was a dismal and depressing Christmas for the Army of the Potomac. Adding insult to their loss at Fredericksburg, many Union soldiers lamented the absence of letters or packages from home, delayed by wartime logistics. On the other side of the river, buoyed by their hard-fought victory just days earlier, Confederates fêted the holidays with a large bonfires, gunfire, and camp music. Regimental histories note that numerous unauthorized truces and fraternizing with the enemy happened up and down the Rappahannock River that Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and New Year's Eve. From shouting greetings across the river to celebrating together around a bonfire to trading supplies, these moments during an uneasy peace were spontaneous and the stuff of movies. That's not hyperbole. A fictionalization of one such Christmas truce made its way into the 2003 movie Gods and Generals, where Billy Yank and Johnny Reb yell across the river, first trading jokes and then coffee and tobacco, in the middle of the Rappahannock. The most notable account of a Christmas truce, however, comes from an essay by Reverend John Paxson and published in Harper's Weekly nearly a quarter century after the end of the Civil War. An enthusiastic and idealistic young man who left college to enlist in the Union Army, Paxson recalled finding himself on duty on Christmas Day, cold, hungry, wet, and having recently witnessed atrocities and survived the Battle of Fredericksburg. In the midst of feeling sorry for himself, Paxton recalled that he heard a Confederate call to the Union soldiers on picket duty. Through a congenial back and forth, according to this account, they discovered that each side had something the other desperately missed. The Confederates had parched corn and tobacco, while Paxton had coffee, sugar, and pork. The Union soldiers produced small, whittled boats that they stuffed with goods and sent across the swiftly moving river. The Confederates raced into the water to retrieve the boats and then refilled them with ripe persimmons, tobacco, and the corn before returning them. The men on both sides spent time enjoying their clandestine bounty, and what a treat it must have been. A Union blockade made coffee extremely rare across the South, raising the price of coffee beans outrageously and ruining morale in the military and civilian communities. Southerners desperately experimented with other products to produce something similar to coffee, including sweet potatoes, peas, chicory, rye, sugarcane, seeds, peanuts, and even asparagus seeds. In the North, tobacco was harder to come by than it had been during peacetime. While the Union produced tobacco as an agricultural product, its yearly yield of 50 million pounds was far below the Confederacy's 225 million pounds. Reflecting on Christmas Day in 62, Paxton noted that, at the very front of the opposing armies, the Christ Child struck a truce of us, broke down the wall of partition, became our peace. We exchanged gifts. We shouted greetings back and forth. We kept Christmas, and our hearts were lighter of it, and our shivering bodies were not quite so cold. Days later, on January 1, 1863, President Lincoln would sign the Emancipation Proclamation. The document freed enslaved people being held in Confederate states that had seceded and were not under Union rule. The document fundamentally transformed the character of the war by explicitly codifying the Union Army as a tool of human rights, backing the personhood of enslaved people with the might of the U.S. government, and allowing black men to enlist in the Federal Army and Navy. While those who enlisted may have had varying reasons for doing so, they were now fighting not only to keep the country together, but to break the chains of slavery and end the white Southern way of life. When the next truce came to the Rappahannock River in May 63, it was far less festive. Under fierce fighting during the Second Battle of Fredericksburg, a truce was negotiated for Union forces to evacuate the wounded and collect their dead. Less than a week later, the fray ended in a decisive Union victory. That's the other Christmas truce. We turn now to militarytimes.com. The website of the Military Times newspaper for this article by Hope Hodge Seck, Camouflage and Tiaras, First Active Duty Miss America Reflects on Year. The extent to which Second Lieutenant Madison Marsh had found herself in uncharted military territory became clear at a NASCAR event in February, where her dual hat duties required her to execute quick changes between her Air Force combat utility uniform and full pageant regalia. Her schedule had her meeting the Air Force Thunderbirds demonstration team and then a collection of military generals before shifting to a more conventional Miss America crowd greeting public appearance at the race. Marsh, 23, who will complete her year as the first active duty Miss America in January, said she realized a level-setting conversation was in order. She scrambled to conform to wildly different appearance standards in rapid succession. Obviously, the Miss America people, they don't know Air Force uniform standards, so no one knows. Oh, wait, you can't wear lashes and a long, giant ponytail and red lipstick and eyeshadow and uniform, Marsh said. And it's like, no, I can't do both of those at once. Eyelashes aside, Marsh, a 2023 U.S. Air Force Academy graduate and Truman Scholar, and whose next plans involve a study program at Harvard, found a mutually beneficial way to serve out her dual identity in 2024. In conversations that began when she was crowned Miss Colorado in May 2023, she began to plan out with her chain of command how it might be feasible and practical to serve out a potential Miss America role while on active duty. I know a lot of people from all across the country on many different bases had to pour in a lot of time after I'd won, she said. Figuring out the legal logistics of what this is going to actually look like and trying to look at some of the Air Force memos and how we can really make this work. Ultimately, the Air Force moved her into a highly customized public affairs position, building off her existing slate of public engagements for Miss America to conduct outreach for the service and generate awareness and interest in joining the military. Since she won the title in January, Marsh said she's participated in 106 Air Force-related public engagements involving conversations with students, parents, and other influencers to promote military service. We've really found an amazing way to overlap both of these jobs to make sure that we're still hitting the standard and reaching people in the environment that we want to reach, she said. Marsh's grueling travel schedule hasn't allowed for many conventional military activities and experiences in what is essentially her first active duty role. Marsh's time spent on base at her home station, Joint Base San Antonio Randolph, Texas, she said, has largely consisted of mandatory activities including drug testing, medical appointments, meetings with commanding officers, and performance reviews. Occasionally, she said, she's gotten recognized by other service members while running errands and utilities in a ball cap. While she enjoys making the connection, she said, it's also a little stressful given the appearance standards and requirements for Miss America. Even last week, I was doing my out processing for my base and showed up work with no makeup, she said. One of the people who worked at the front was like, oh, we've got to get the major. Even sans makeup, she said, she agreed to a group photo with the office staff. Everyone always has the opportunity to do small things for other people and make their day, Marsh said, so that's been cool to give people joy like that this year. Even apart from her top title in one of the nation's most prestigious pageant competitions, Marsh's achievements and aspirations demonstrate her fearlessness. She's had internships with prestigious organizations such as NASA, become an activist for pancreatic cancer research at age 17 following the death of her mother from the disease, has a black belt in Taekwondo, and possesses a pilot's license, which seeded her initial ambition to fly for the Air Force. Marsh told Military Times her experience in military training should be an encouragement to young women who fear they couldn't hack it in uniform or at war. Polling data made public by the Defense Department in December showed that just 1 in 4 women aged 16 to 21 believe they could make it through boot camp, and just 8% believe they have what it takes to fight in a war. When I entered basic training, I was 17 years old. I was on the cheer team in high school. I was very scrawny, maybe 110 pounds, Marsh said. I worked very hard the year before I went into basic to make sure I was going to go above and beyond the standards that were going to be expected of me, and also having the mental resilience to keep going when you fail. I think that willingness to learn is going to carry people so much farther, and also not closing yourself off from opportunities. Reflecting on her experiences as a Truman Scholar and her upcoming studies at the Harvard Kennedy School, Marsh noted, I never would have gotten that if I would have counted myself out before I even showed up to basic. After Marsh hands off her crown, she's headed to Hanscom Air Base, Massachusetts, where she'll complete her final year plus of studies to earn a Master's of Public Policy from Harvard under the Air Force Institute of Technology's Civilian Institutions program. With her fiancé also in the Air Force, Marsh said she plans to continue to serve, though she's not fully certain how long she'll be in or what military career she'll pursue. While she initially joined through a desire to be a pilot, Marsh said she's ruled out a return to flight training, adding that she wants to find a service job that she's fully passionate about. The Air Force has treated me extremely well so far, she said, so I can only imagine what other opportunities are going to be in store. That's Camouflage and Tiaras, first active duty Miss America reflects on year. You're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, which is now available on the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And finally, you can also listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Echo or Dot device. Our next article from Military Times is by Riley Cedar. Indigenous World War I veterans get long-awaited Medal of Honor review. I'm so thankful that his blood runs in our veins, said Tijuana Anderson Edwards of her great uncle Otis W. Leader, a World War I Choctaw code talker. Leader, a corporal in the Army's 16th Infantry Regiment, 1st Infantry Division, once destroyed a machine gun nest single-handedly after some of his men had been killed, capturing 2 machine guns and defeating 18 enemy soldiers in the process. He would go on to receive the Purple Heart, the Silver Star Medal, the Victory Medal, and French Croix de Guerre with Palm, among other awards. General John J. Pershing even once referred to Leader as one of the war's greatest fighting machines, according to the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. But despite those accolades, Leader and other World War I code talkers, service members who used indigenous languages to create undecipherable communications, still haven't received the recognition they deserve, Edward believes. There's just no telling how many lives they saved, Edwards told Military Times. A move to rectify that, however, may be on the horizon. Leader is one of a group of Indigenous veterans who are currently being reviewed as potential recipients of the Medal of Honor more than a century after they served. In all, roughly 12,000 Native Americans served during World War I. It's my ultimate goal to see that he gets his due recognition. He so deserved it, Edwards said. He wasn't just a code talker, he was a war hero. Leader's eligibility for the Medal of Honor comes as part of the World War I Valor Medals Review Act, which is passed as part of the 2018 National Defense Authorization Act. The law allows for a review of actions by non-white veterans who served in World War I to determine whether select acts of valor, which were during that period often diminished due to one's skin color, warrant the nation's highest military honor. To qualify, veterans from various racial backgrounds must have been awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, Navy Cross, French Croix de Guerre with Palm, or have been recommended for a Medal of Honor. Once such a service record is brought to the attention of the Army or Navy, the Associated Branch reviews the record and issues a determination regarding award status. As part of that process, the Pentagon was advised to collaborate with the Valor Medals Review Task Force, a joint operation run by the World War I Centennial Commission and Park University's George S. Robb Center for the Study of the Great War. Dr. Timothy Westcott, the Missouri-based department's director, told Military Times he first became interested in the subject after he saw a university presentation during Black History Month about Sergeant William A. Butler, a Black war hero who was nominated for but never received the Medal of Honor. In September 1918, George S. Robb, the department's namesake, was recommended for a Medal of Honor on the same piece of paper as Butler. While Robb would go on to receive the nation's highest military decoration, Butler would be presented a Distinguished Service Cross. From there, Westcott got involved with the Centennial Commission, which oversaw the Valor Medals Review Project and Task Force, and researched veteran service records to make retroactive award recommendations to the Pentagon and Congress. When the commission disbanded in 2024 after completing the National World War I Memorial in Washington, the Robb Center took charge of that effort. So far, Westcott and the department have identified 214 service members from World War I who met the criteria for the Medal of Honor eligibility. Of those, 24 are Indigenous veterans. We've submitted 56 total nomination packets, he said, noting that the process is particularly grueling. It takes us about 6 to 9 months to write a nomination packet, and those are approximately 150 to 165 pages in length each. Of the 56 packets Westcott's team has submitted, 49 have been sent to the Army, the other 7 have gone to the Navy. There's currently no timeline for approval. Once Westcott and his team submit the packet, there's limited contact between the center and the service, he said. Since the department submitted its first packet in 2022, the Army has provided just 1 follow-up communication. Before it disbanded, the Centennial Commission worked with the Sequoia National Research Center at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock to build a database of all Indigenous personnel who served in World War I. Aaron Fair, the assistant director and archivist for Sequoia, who helped construct the database, told Military Times that the idea for it came up after she put up a 2017 exhibit on the World War I Code Talkers. Most people associate Code Talkers with World War II, when in reality they began in the First World War, she said. But as Fair was getting the exhibit together, a lack of public awareness of Indigenous military service during the First World War became apparent. Visitors didn't even realize that Native people were involved in the war at all, said Fair, who is Yupik. So, Fair embarked on a journey to find as many names of Native American service members from World War I as possible to establish a wall of honor, listing veterans by tribal affiliation. In 3 months, she and the center discovered 2,300 names that they taped to a wall in the exhibit for the visitors to see. But there was much more work to do. We haven't found those 12,000 names, she said. Since then, Fair and Sequoia have been relentless in compiling a comprehensive list, with the team currently tracking around 6,200 names. Westcott approached Fair sometime in late 2018, early 2019, Fair said, and asked for the center's assistance in finding Indigenous service members who may be eligible for the Medal of Honor under the World War I Valor Medals Review Act. Fair jumped at the opportunity to collaborate. The whole purpose behind this project was not to keep the information for ourselves, she said. Fair said a good portion of her research and findings have come from periodicals released by the American Indian boarding school system, since many service members had been sent to such places during their youth. American Indian boarding schools were erected in the late 19th century and devised as a way to eradicate the traditions and languages of Indigenous peoples, oftentimes through verbal, physical, and sexual abuse, while forcing assimilation. There were more than 523 such schools operating at one time, according to the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. Kill the Indian in him and save the man, said R.H. Pratt, the founder and superintendent of Carlisle Indian Industrial School, the first federally run Indigenous boarding school. A recent Washington Post investigation found that more than 3,100 students died at American Indian boarding schools, more than 3 times the amount the U.S. government previously reported. Fair pointed out the grim paradox at play for Native Americans who attended boarding schools and then joined the ranks. All their lives they've been chastised for speaking their language. In many cases, it was beaten out of them. But when they enlisted to serve the country that had wronged them, it was their language, they were told, was key to defeating the enemy. Fair also explained that the military was unsure how to handle Native American enlistees leading up to World War I because of boarding schools. Considering the goal of schools was to achieve assimilation into white culture, keeping Indigenous troops separate would signal that the federally funded schools had failed. The U.S. ultimately decided to integrate the ranks. Among those men was Leader, of whom Edwards says she now has only vague memories, namely his palpable warmth and beautiful smile. He was like a big Santa Claus to me, she said. Because of Leader's demeanor, no one would ever guess the tragedies and adversity he faced in the war, she added. But his story is one Edwards hopes will soon be recognized with the highest military honor, and it's one of many in the Indigenous community she hopes will be widely shared. We're just now beginning to find a balance, she said, between never forgetting and moving forward with all this. That's Indigenous World War I veterans get long-awaited Medal of Honor review. We're going to turn now to the Veterans Administration. I just received notification of a change in their procedures, and I'm sure that many of you also received this, but they are going to a different login procedure. Starting in 2025, you'll need to use a login.gov or id.me account to sign into all VA websites and apps, including va.gov, the MyHealth eVet website, and the VA Health and Benefits mobile app. Keep reading to learn about creating a free login.gov or id.me account to manage your VA benefits, services, and information online. And if you go to this page, www.va.gov/creating-an-account-for-VA-GOV, that's VA-GOV, all one word. That page will essentially be what I'll be talking about today, is all the information you need to create a login.gov or id.me login so that you can get on to your VA website for your information and benefits. This page provides step-by-step instructions, how to choose your account, creating your account, and preparing for VA sign-in changes. They'll guide you through each step of creating your login.gov or id.me account for VA. And if you want to learn more about choosing between a login.gov or an id.me account, or if you have questions about creating your account or preparing for VA's sign-in changes in 2025, this is the web page you need. Okay, choosing your account. Why should I create a login.gov or id.me account? You can access and manage your VA benefits, healthcare, and information online. You can use your account to sign into va.gov, VA mobile apps, and any other VA online service. And here are some things you can do with an account. Apply for benefits, check your claim status, update your address and other contact information across several VA benefits and services, check the status of and request help with any benefit overpayments or copay bills you may have. You can also do these things to manage your health. You can refill prescriptions, communicate privately and securely with your healthcare team, request or schedule some health appointments, review lab and test results. You can also use your account to sign into some other government websites to manage benefits like Social Security benefits. So, what type of account should I create to manage my VA benefits? You can create a login.gov or id.me account. Login.gov is our government's one account provider for VA and other government benefits and services. The U.S. General Services Administration creates and maintains your account. ID.me is a non-government account provider that contracts with the government and non-government organizations. ID.me creates and maintains your account. Both accounts meet modern security standards and protect your data, so only you can access and change your stored information. Both accounts let you use a single secure account to access your VA and some other government benefits and services. If you live outside the U.S., don't have a Social Security number, or don't have a current driver's license or other state-issued ID, you'll need to choose ID.me. If your phone is on a plan that's not in your name and you want to verify your identity online, you'll need to choose ID.me. So, creating your account, how do I create a login.gov account? You can create your account for VA on the login.gov website. Here's what you'll need: an email address, a unique password that includes at least 12 characters. When you set up your account, you'll need to set up multi-factor authentication. The first time you use your account to manage your VA benefits or information, you'll need to verify your identity. And here's what you'll need: your driver's license or other state-issued ID, and your Social Security number, and a U.S. phone number. Note, if you don't have a U.S. phone number, login.gov can send a letter to your mailing address instead. Now, what does it mean to verify my identity, and why do I have to do it? Identity verification is a one-time process that they ask you to complete for your login.gov or ID.me account. The process often takes about 10 minutes. During this process, the account provider, login.gov or ID.me, will ask you to provide certain personal information and identification. This process helps us make sure that the person creating your account is really you, not someone pretending to be you. It's a lot like the process for setting up a bank account. Identity verification is not about whether we trust that you're who we say you are. It's about protecting you from scammers who may try to set up an account in your name to access your information and benefits. After you verify your identity, you won't have to do it again for that account unless you lose access to your account's multi-factor authentication method or need to recreate your account. In the future, we may ask you to help us re-verify your identity once every several years for added protection. How do I create an ID.me account? You can create your account on the ID.me website. Here's what you'll need: an email address, a unique password that includes at least 8 characters with at least 1 uppercase letter, 1 lowercase letter, and 1 number. When you set up your account, you'll need to set up multi-factor authentication. And the first time you use your account to manage your VA benefits or information, you'll need to verify your identity. And again, here's what you'll need: a phone number and your driver's license, state-issued ID, passport, or passport card. What if I'm not sure if I already have an account? Many people can create accounts, but they forget they have them over time. The best way to find out if you already have a login.gov or ID.me account is to try and create a new one. To create a new account, go to our va.gov sign-in page, then select Create an Account with login.gov or Create an Account with ID.me. If you try to create an account and you already have one, the sign-in service provider will tell you. You can then try to reset your email. Can I get a login.gov or ID.me account if I don't have a mobile phone? Yes, you'll just need to use alternate methods to verify your identity and add multi-factor authentication. For login.gov, you can verify your identity at a participating U.S. post office, or you can verify online and upload images of your ID from a computer. If you have no U.S. phone number at all, you may be able to verify your address by mail. For ID.me, you can verify your identity for your account on a video call with a trusted ID.me agent. You'll need to upload photos of your ID documents from a computer, and you'll need a webcam for the video call. For both accounts, you can choose a multi-factor authentication method that doesn't require a mobile phone. You can use a security key, a call to a landline, or backup codes. What if I'm having trouble creating my login.gov or ID.me account? We can help guide you to fix some common issues. You create your account and verify your identity. And here they have links to support for common issues, or you can get more help on account providers' websites. And you go to the login.gov help center or the ID.me support section. How does multi-factor authentication differ from identity verification? Identity verification and multi-factor authentication work together to protect your identity and personal information. Identity verification is a one-time process. You complete this process when you first set up your sign-in account. To verify your identity, you provide certain personal information and identification. Identity verification helps us make sure only you can create your sign-in account and no scammer can create one in your name. Multi-factor authentication is an extra layer of protection as part of the process of signing in to use your account. When you first set up your account, you set up your choice of multi-factor authentication method, like an authenticator app, on a device only you have access to. Then you use that method to provide a specific code we send you each time you sign in. Multi-factor authentication helps us make sure only you can use your sign-in account to access and manage your benefits and health care. Preparing for VA sign-in changes. What's changing for VA sign-in accounts in 2025? We're moving to a simpler, more modern sign-in experience in 2025 with two secure sign-in account options. That's login.gov and id.me. Here's what will change for veterans and beneficiaries like you. After January 31st, 2025, you won't be able to sign in to va.gov, VA mobile apps, or other VA online services with a MyHealthEVet user ID and password. After September 30th, 2025, you won't be able to sign in with a DS logon, username, and password. You'll have two sign-in account options that meet modern security standards, a login.gov or ID.me account. You'll be able to use your account to sign in to all VA websites and apps to manage your VA benefits and care. You'll need to use a unique email address and set up multi-factor authentication for your account. No worry, your MyHealthEVet health portal isn't going away. You just need to sign into it with a login.gov or ID.me account. Will I still be able to manage my healthcare through MyHealthEVet? Yes, your MyHealthEVet health portal isn't going away. You'll still be able to manage your healthcare through MyHealthEVet, but you'll need to use either a login.gov or an ID.me account to sign in to do that. When you create your account, you'll need to verify your identity and add multi-factor authentication as an added layer of protection, making this change to continue to protect all veterans' information and benefits. You may also have questions about our effort to build a new home for MyHealthEVet over the next 2 years. MyHealthEVet's new home on va.gov will give you a single place to manage your healthcare needs in the same location where you manage all your other VA benefits and services. You'll continue to have access to all your trusted health tools. Why will VA only allow two sign-in account options with this change? Here's why we'll only allow two modern, secure sign-in account options. Those are login.gov and ID.me. Veterans have told us many times over several years that they want fewer account options and they want to be able to use their chosen sign-in account to access all of their VA benefits and care. Identity theft and related medical identity theft are serious issues that can cause severe financial hardship and disruption in medical care for veterans and their families. 2023, the Federal Trade Commission received more than 1 million reports of identity theft. That same year, veterans and military retirees also reported to the FTC $350 million in losses to fraud. And they're required by federal policy to help all veterans begin using a sign-in account that meets modern security standards. We're also required to simplify the sign-in experience for veterans. Login.gov and ID.me help us meet both these requirements. What if I don't get a login.gov or ID.me account in time? Don't worry, you won't lose any stored information. You can always manage your VA benefits and care by phone, by mail, or in person. But you'll need to create your login.gov or ID.me account to access your information and manage your benefits and care online. Again, what if I don't want to get a login.gov or ID.me account? Well, it's always your choice whether you want to get an account, but choice won't affect your eligibility for VA benefits or healthcare in any way. If you don't get a login.gov or ID.me account before we remove the MyHealthEVet and DS login sign-in options, you won't be able to access your VA information or manage your benefits and care online. but you can always manage your VA benefits and health care by phone, by mail, or in person. And they have a list of phone numbers that's available on that website that I'll repeat at the end of this article. Will I have to add multi-factor authentication with this change? Yes, both login.gov and ID.me require multi-factor authentication as part of the account setup process. The extra layer of protection helps us make sure that it's you trying to use your sign-in account and not someone pretending to be you. Multi-factor authentication is a common practice for many websites and apps. You may already use it to access your email, bank account, or social media accounts. When you set up your login.gov or ID.me account, you can choose the multi-factor authentication option that works best for you. Okay, that's the article on the changes to the login procedures for va.gov for 2025, and all that's available on www.va.gov/resources/creating-an-account-for-va-gov. And the last part of that, creating an account for VAGOV, all those words are separated by hyphens. And that was information on the changes in 2025 for logging in to VA.GOV. You've been listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader in Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman. Thank you for joining me for this Boxing Day edition. I hope you all had a very Merry Christmas. And remember, you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app available at the Apple App Store or Google Play Store, or finally on the Amazon.org. or Echo device, and just ask Alexa for the Sun Sounds of Arizona stream. Happy New Year, everybody.